She thought to laugh, decided that it might come out too obviously hurt, which would make him feel even worse. Besides, her comment had been little more than desperate misdirection. She'd lost most of the weight she'd put on during her pregnancy.
"Barathol, has it not occurred to you that maybe I am as I am because behind it all there's not much else?"
His frown deepened. Chara dropped down from the crate and came over. He patted her on the head with a sticky hand and then hurried off into the yard.
"But you've lived through so much."
"And you haven't? Gods below, you were an officer in the Red Blades. What you did in Arran
was just me avoiding a mess, Ilara, as usual."
"What are we talking about here?"
His eyes shied away.
"I'm not sure. I suppose, now that Cutter's left you,
and the Dyker's too old and Picker's a woman, and that's fun but not serious, for me at least, I found myself in need of another man. Char's a child, in his head, that is. Leaving you."
The harsh sarcasm of her voice stung him, and he almost stepped back.
"From where I'm standing," he said.
"Well," she said, sighing, "it's probably what I deserve, actually. I've been a bit loose, wayward, looking, trying, not finding, trying again and again. From where you're standing, yes, I can see that."
"None of that would matter to me," Barathol then said. "Except, well, I don't want to be just another man left in your wake."
"No wonder you've devoted your life to making weapons and armor. Problem is, you're doing that for everyone else."
He said nothing. He simply watched her, as she realized he had been doing for some time now. All at once, Ilara felt uncomfortable. She drew hard on her pipe.
"Barathol, you need some armor of your own."
And he nodded.
"I see."
"I'm not going to make promises I can't keep. Still, it may be that my waywardness is coming to an end. People like us who spend all our time looking, well, even when we find it, we usually don't realize until it's too late."
"Cutter."
She squinted up at him.
"He had no room left in his heart, Barathol. Not for me, not for anyone."
"So he's just hiding right now?"
"In more ways than one, I suspect."
"But he's broken your heart, Ilara."
"Has he?"
She considered.
"Maybe he has. Maybe I'm the one needing armor."
She snorted.
"Puts me in my place, doesn't it?"
And she rose. Barathol started.
"Where are you going?"
"What? I don't know. Somewhere. Nowhere. Does it matter?"
"Wait."
He stepped closer.
"Listen to me, Ilara."
And then he was silent, on his face a war of feelings trying to find words. After a moment, his scowl deepened.
"Yesterday, if Cutter had just walked in here to say hello, I'd have taken him by the throat. Hood, I'd have probably beaten him unconscious and tied him up in that chair, where he'd stay until you dropped by."
"Yesterday.
When I thought I had no chance."
She was having her own trouble finding words.
"And now?"
"I think I've just thrown on some armor."
"The soldier unretires."
"Well, I'm a man, and a man never learns."
She grinned.
"That's true enough."
And then she leaned close, and as he slowly raised his arms to take her into an embrace, she almost shut her eyes. All that relief, all that anticipation of pleasure, even joy, and the hands instead grasped her upper arms, and she was pushed suddenly to one side. Startled, she turned to see a squad of city guard crowding the doorway. The officer in the lead had the decency to look embarrassed.
"Barathol Mekkar, by city order, this smithy is now under temporary closure, and I'm afraid I have to take you into custody."
"The charge?"
"Brought forward by the Guild of Smiths. Contravention of proper waste disposal. It is a serious charge, I'm afraid. You could lose your business."
"I don't understand," Barathol said. "I am making use of the sewage drains. I spill nothing."
"The common drain, yes. But you should be using the industrial drain, which runs alongside the common drain."
"This is the first I have heard of such a thing."
"Well," said a voice behind the guards, "if you were a member of the guild, you'd know all about it, wouldn't you?"
It was a woman who spoke, but Solara could not see past the men in the doorway. Barathol threw up his hands.
Very well, I am happy to comply. I will install the proper pipes.
You may do so, said the officer, once the charges are properly adjudicated, fines paid, and so forth. In the meantime, this establishment must be shut down. The gas valves must be sealed, materials and tools impounded.
I see. Then let me make some arrangement for my helper, somewhere to stay, and...
I'm sorry, cut in the officer, but the charge is against both you and your apprentice.
Not precisely, said the unseen woman. The blacksmith cannot have an apprentice unless he is a member of the guild. The two are colluding to undermine the guild.
The officer's expression tightened.
As she said, yes. I'm not here to prattle on in the language of an advocate. I do the arrest and leave one of my guards to oversee the decommissioning of the establishment by a qualified crew.
A moment, said Barathol. You are arresting Chaur?
Is that your apprentice's name?
He's not my apprentice. He's a simpleton.
Little more than a slave, then, snapped the unseen official of the guild. That would be breaking a much more serious law, I should think.
Solara watched as two men went to the yard and returned with a wide-eyed, whimpering Char. Barathol attempted to console him, but guards stepped in between them, and the officer warned that, while he didn't want to make use of shackles, he would if necessary. So, if everyone could stay calm and collected, they could march out of here like civilized folk. Barathol inquired as to his right to hire an advocate, and the officer replied that, while it wasn't a right as such, it was indeed a privilege Barathol could exercise, assuming he could afford one. At that point, Solara spoke up and said,
I'll find one for you, Barathol.
A flicker of relief and gratitude in his eyes, replaced almost immediately by his distress over the fate of Chaur, who was now bawling and tugging his arms free every time a guard sought to take hold of him.
Let him alone, said Barathol. He'll follow peacefully enough. Just don't grab him.
And then the squad, save one, all marched out with their prisoners. Solara fell in behind them and finally saw the guild official, a rather imposing woman whose dignity was marred by the self-satisfied smirk on her face. As Solara passed behind the woman, she took hold of her braid and gave it a sharp downward tug.
Ow!
The woman whirled, her expression savage.
Sorry, Solara said. Must have caught on my bracelet.
And as Solara continued on down the street, she heard from the squad officer,
She's not wearing any bracelet!
The guild woman hissed and said,
I want her!
And then Solara turned the corner. She did not expect the officer to send anyone in pursuit. The man was doing his job and had no interest in complicating things.
And there I was, she muttered under her breath, about to trap a very fine man in my messed-up web, hoping, praying, that he'd be the one to untangle my life, she snorted. Just my luck.
From rank superstitions to scholarly treatises, countless generations had sought understanding of those among them whose minds stayed undeveloped, childlike, or, indeed, seemingly trapped in some other world. God and demon possession, stolen souls, countless chemical imbalances and unpleasant humours, injuries sustained at birth or even before, blows to the head as a child, fevers and so on. What could never be achieved, of course, barring elaborate, dangerous rituals of spirit-walking, was to venture into the mind of one thus afflicted. It would be easy to assume an inner world of simple feelings, frightening unknowns and the endless miasma of confusion, or some incorporeal demon crouched down on every thought, crushing the life from it, choking off every possible passage to awareness. Such assumptions, naturally, are but suppositions founded only on external observation. The careful regard of seemingly blank eyes and stupid smiles, repetitive behavior and unfounded fears. Hold tight, then, this hand, on this momentary journey into Chaur's mind. The world he was witness to was a place of objects, some moving, some never moving, and some that were still but could be moved if one so willed it. These three types were not necessarily fixed, and he well knew that things that seemed destined to immobility could suddenly come awake, alive, in explosive motion. Within himself, Chower possessed apprehensions of all three in ever-shifting forms. There was love, a deeply rooted object, from which came warmth and joy and a sense of perfect well-being. It could, on occasion, reach out to take in another, someone or something on the outside, but ultimately that was not necessary. The love was within him, its very own world, and he could go there any time he liked. This was expressed in a rather dreamy smile, an expression disengaged with everything on the outside. Powerful as it was, love was vulnerable. It could be wounded, jabbed into recoiling pain. When this happened, another object was stirred awake. It could be called hate, but its surface was mottled with fear and anger. This object was fixed as deeply in his soul as was love, and the two needed each other even if their relationship was strained, fraught. Prodded into life by love's pain, hate opened eyes that could only look outward, never to oneself, never even to the identity known as Char. Hate blazed in one direction and one only, to the outer world with its objects, some moving, some not, some that might do either, shifting from one to the next and back again. Hate could, if it must, make use of Char's body, in lashing out, in a frenzied reordering of the world, to bring it back into the right shape, to force an end to whatever caused love its pain. All of this depended upon observation, but such observation did not rely overmuch on what he saw, or heard, smelled, touched, or tasted. Hate's secret vision was much sharper. It saw colours that did not exist for others, and those colours were, on an instinctive level, encyclopedic. Seeing them, Hate knew everything, knew indeed far beyond what a normal mind might achieve. Was this little more than a peculiar sensitivity to nonverbal communication? Don't ask Char. He is, after all, in his own world. His object, called Hate, had a thing about blood. Its hue, the way it flowed, the way it smelled and tasted, and this was a bizarre truth. His Hate loved blood. To see it, to immerse oneself in it, was to feel joy and warmth and contentment. The guards flanking Chower, walking at ease and with modest thoughts of their own, had no inkling of all that swirled in the seemingly simple mind of their prisoner, who walked, limbs loose and swinging, now that the natural tension that had bound up the huge man's neck and shoulders had eased away. Clearly the oaf had forgotten all the trouble he was in, had forgotten that they were all walking to a jail, that soon Chower would find himself inside a cage of stolid black iron bars. All those thick walls enclosing the simpleton's brain were clearly back in place. Not worth a second glance. And so there were none to see the hate-filled eyes peering out through every crack, every murder hole, every arrow slit. 1,000, 10,000 glittering eyes seeing everything, the frenzied flicking as immobile objects were observed, gauged, and then discarded, as others were adjudged potentially useful as things that, while unmoving, could be made to move. Seeing all, yes, absorbing and processing at speeds that would stun one of normal intelligence, because this was something different, something alien, something almost perfect in its own way, by its own rules, by all the forces it could assemble, harbour, and then, when the time was appropriate, unleash upon a most unsuspecting world. The simple ones aren't simple. The broken ones aren't broken. They are rearranged. For better, for worse? Such judgments are without relevance. After all, imagine a world where virtually every mind is simpler than it imagines itself to be, or is so utterly broken that it is itself unaware of its own massive, stunning dysfunction. In such a world, life goes on, and madness thrives, stupidity repeats, behaviours destroy and destroy again and again, yet remain impervious to enlightenment. Crimes against humanity abound, and not one victimizer can even comprehend one day becoming victim. Not a single cruel soul understands that cruelty delivered yields cruelty repaid tenfold.
It is enough to eat today and let tomorrow's children starve. Wealth ever promises protection against the strictures of an unkind, avaricious world, and yet fails to deliver on that promise every single time, be the slayer disease, betrayal, or the ravaging mobs of revolution. Wealth cannot comprehend that the very avarice it fears is its own creation, the toxic waste product of its own glorious exaltation. Imagine such a world, then. Oh, don't bother. Better to pity poor dumb Char, who, without warning, exploded into motion. Placid thoughts in guardian skulls shattered into oblivion as fists smashed, sending each man flying out to the side. As dulled senses of something awry shot the first spurt of chemical alarm through the nearest of the remaining guards, Chower reached him, picked him up by belt and neck, and threw him against a happily immobile stone wall on the right. The officer and the last guard both began their whirl to confront the still mostly unknown threat, and Chow, smiling, was there to meet them. He had in his left hand, gripped by one ear, a heavy amphora, which he had collected from a stall to his left, and he brought this object round to crash into the officer. Clay shards, a shower of pellet grain, and in their midst a crumpling body. The last guard, one hand tugging at his sword, mouth open to begin a shout of alarm, saw in his last conscious moment Char and his broad smile, as the simpleton, with a roundhouse swing, drove his fist into the side of the man's head, collapsing the helm on that side and sending the headpiece flying. In a welter of blood from ear and temple, the guard fell to the ground, alive but temporarily unwilling to acknowledge the fact. And Chower stood now facing Barathol, with such pleased, excited eyes that the blacksmith could only stare back, speechless, aghast. Gorlas Vidicus stepped out from the carriage and paused to adjust his leggings, noting with faint displeasure the discordant creases sitting in that sweaty carriage had left him with, and then glanced up as the sickly foreman wheezed his way over.
"Noble sir," he gasped, "about the interest payments. I've been ill, as you know."
"You're dying, you fool," Gorlas snapped. "I'm not here to discuss your problems. We both know what will happen should you default on the loan, and we both know, I should trust, that you are not long for this world, which makes the whole issue irrelevant. The only question is whether you will die in your bed or end up getting tossed out on your backside." After a moment, he stepped closer and slapped the man on his back, triggering a cloud of dust. "You've always got your shack here at camp, yes? Come now, it's time to discuss other matters." The foreman blinked up at him, with all that pathetic piteousness perfected by every loser the world over. Better, of course, than the dark gleam of malice the stupid ones were quick to hate once they'd got a sense of how they'd been duped. No, best keep this one making all those mewling help-me faces. Gorlas smiled. "You can stay in your lovely new home, friend. I will forego the interest payments so you can leave this world in peace and comfort." And oh, wasn't this such extraordinary favour? This concession, this grave sacrifice, why, it would not be remiss if this idiot fell to his knees in abject gratitude, but never mind that. A second thump on the back, this one triggering a coughing fit from the old man. Gorlas walked to the edge of the vast pit and surveyed the bustling hive of activity below. "All is well." The foreman, after hacking out a palmful of yellow phlegm, hobbled up to stand hunched beside him, wiping a hand on a caked trouser leg.
"Well enough, sir, yes, well enough indeed."
"See how his mood has improved? No doubt eaten up with worry all morning, the poor useless bastard. Well, the world needed such creatures, didn't it? To do all the dirty, hard work, and then thank people like Gorlas for the privilege. You're so very welcome, you stupid fool. And see this? It's my smile of indulgence. Bask and bask well. It's the only thing I give away that's truly free." "How many losses this week?"
"3. Average, sir. That's average as can be. 1 mole in a cave-in. The others died of the grey-face sickness. We got the new vein producing now. Would you believe? It's red iron.
Gorlas's brows lifted. Red iron? A quick, eager nod.
Twice the price at half weight, that stuff. Seems there's growing demand.
Yes, the Malazan longswords everyone's lusting after. Well, this will make it easier to order one, since up to now only one smith had the skill to make the damned weapons. He shook his head. Ugly things, if you ask me. Curious thing is, we don't get red iron round here. Not till now, that is. So how was the fool making such perfect copies?
Well, noble sir, there's an old legend about how one can actually turn regular iron into the red stuff, and do it cheap besides. Maybe it ain't just a legend.
Gorlas grunted. Interesting. Imagine finding out that secret, being able to take regular iron, toss in something virtually worthless, and out comes red iron, worth 4 times the price. You've just given me an idea, he murmured, though I doubt the smith would give up the secret. No, I'd have to pay a lot.
Maybe a partnership,
the foreman ventured. Gorlas scowled. He wasn't asking for advice. Still, yes, a partnership might work. Something he'd heard about that smith, some guild trouble. Well, could be Gorlas could smooth all that over for a consideration. Never mind, he said, a tad overloud. It was just a notion. I've already discarded it as too complicated, too messy. Let's forget we ever discussed it.
Yes, sir.
But was the foreman looking oddly thoughtful? Might be necessary, Gorlas reflected, to hasten this fool's demise. From up the road behind them, a trader's cart was approaching. Stupid, really. He'd elected to wear his riding boots, but the things were ancient, worn, and it seemed his feet had flattened out some since he'd last used them, and now he had enormous blisters, damned painful ones. And so, for all his plans of a stentorian, impressive arrival at the camp, full of dour intent and an edge of bluster, to then be ameliorated by a handful of silver counsels, a relieved foreman sending a runner off to retrieve the wayward child, Murillo found himself on the back of a rickety cart, covered in dust and sweating in the midst of a cloud of flies. Well, he would just have to make the best of it, wouldn't he? As the ox halted at the top of the ridgeline, the old man walking slow as a snail over to where stood the eponymous foreman beside some fancy noble, now both looking their way, Murillo eased himself down, wincing at the lancing pain shooting up his legs, thinking with dread of the long walk back to the city, his hand holding Harlow's tiny one, with darkness crawling up from the ditches to either side. A long, long walk indeed, and how he'd manage it was, truth be told, beyond him. Soldiers knew about blisters, didn't they? And men and women who worked hard for a living. To others, the affliction seemed trivial, a minor irritation. And when there were years between this time and the last time one had suffered from them, it was easy to forget, to casually dismiss just how debilitating they truly were. Raw leather rubbed at each one like ground glass as he settled his weight back down. Still, it would not do to hobble over, and so, mustering all his will, Murillo walked, one careful step at a time, to where the foreman and the nobleman stood discussing things with the carter. As he drew closer, his gaze narrowed on the high-born one, a hint of recognition. But where? When? The carter had been told by the foreman where to take the supplies, and off he went, with a passing nod at Murillo. The foreman was squinting curiously, and as Murillo drew up before them, he spat to one side and said,
"You look lost, sir. If you've the coin, you can buy a place at the workers' table. It's plain fare, but filling enough, though we don't serve nothing but weak ale."
He barked a laugh.
"We ain't no roadside inn, are we?"
Murillo had thought long on how he would approach this, but he had not expected a damned nobleman in this particular scene, and something whispered to him that what should have been a simple negotiation, concluded by paying twice the going rate for a 5-year-old boy, might now turn perilously complicated.
"Are you the foreman of the camp, sir?"
he asked, after a deferential half-bow to the nobleman. At the answering nod, Murillo continued,
"Very good. I am here in search of a young boy, name of Harlow, who was sold to your camp a few weeks back."
He quickly raised a gloved hand.
"No, I have no desire to challenge the propriety of that arrangement. Rather, I wish to purchase the boy's freedom, and so deliver him back to his, terribly distressed parents."
"Do ye now?"
The foreman looked over at the nobleman. Yes, Murillo thought he might know this young man. "You are the one named Murillo," the nobleman said, with an odd glitter in his gaze.
"You have the better of me."
"That goes without saying. I am the principal investor of this operation. I am also a counselor, Gorlas Vidicus of House Vidicus." Murillo bowed a second time, as much to hide his dismay as in proper deference.
"Counselor Vidicus, it is a pleasure meeting you."
"Is it? I very much doubt that. It took me a few moments to place you. You were pointed out, you see, a couple of years back at some estate fete."
"Oh, well, there was a time when I was..."
"You were on a list," Gorlas cut in.
"A what?"
"A hobby of a friend of mine, although I doubt he would have seen it as a hobby. In fact, if I was so careless as to use that word when it came to his list, he'd probably call me out."
"I am sorry," Murillo said, "but I'm afraid I do not know what you are talking about. Some sort of list, you said?"
"Likely conspirators," Gorlas said with a faint smile, "in the murder of Turban Orr, not to mention Ravid Lim. Or was it some other limb? I don't recall now, but then that hardly matters. No, Turban Orr, and of course the suspicious suicide of Lady Simtal, all on the same night in her estate. I was there, did you know that? I saw Turban Orr assassinated with my own eyes." And he was in truth smiling now, as if recalling something yielding waves of nostalgia. But his eyes were hard, fixed like sword points. "My friend, of course, is Hanot Orr, and the list is his."
"I do recall attending the Simtal fete," Murillo said, and in his mind he was reliving those moments after leaving the lady's bedchamber, leaving her with the means by which she could take her own life, and his thoughts then of everything he had surrendered and what it might mean for his future. Appropriate, then, that it should now return to crouch at his feet like a rabid dog with fangs bared. "Alas, I missed the duel."
"It was no duel, Murillo. Turban Orr was provoked. He was set up. He was assassinated in plain view. Murder, not a duel. Do you even comprehend the difference?" The foreman was staring back and forth between them with all the dumb bewilderment of an ox.
"I do, sir, but as I said, I was not there to witness the event."
"You call me a liar, then?"
"Excuse me?"
Gods below, 10 years passed, and he would have handled this with perfect grace and mocking equanimity. And all that was ruffled would be smoothed over, certain debts accepted, promises of honouring those debts not even needing explicit enunciation. 10 years passed, and... "You are calling me a liar."
"No, I do not recall doing so, Counselor. If you say Turban Orr was assassinated, then so be it. As for my somehow conspiring to bring it about, well, that is itself a very dangerous accusation."
Oh, he knew where this was leading. He had known for some time, in fact. It was all there in Gorlas Vidicus's eyes, and Murillo now recalled where he had last seen this man and heard of him. Gorlas enjoyed dueling. He enjoyed killing his opponents. Yes, he had attended one of this bastard's duels, and he had seen...
"It seems," said Gorlas, "we have ourselves a challenge to honour here."
He gave a short laugh.
"When you retracted your accusation, well, I admit I thought you were about to tuck your tail between your legs and scuttle off down the road. And perhaps I would have let you go at that. It's Hanot's obsession, after all, not mine."
Murillo said nothing, understanding how he had trapped himself, with the foreman to witness the fact that the demand for a duel had come from him, not Gorlas Vidicus. He also understood that there had been no chance, none at all, that Gorlas would have let him go.
"Naturally," continued the counsellor, "I have no intention of withdrawing my accusation, so either accept it or call me out, Murillo. I have vague recollections that you were once judged a decent duelist."
He scanned the track to either side.
"This place seems well suited. Now, a miserable enough audience, granted, but—"
"Excuse me,"
cut in the foreman,
"but the day's shift bell is about to sound. The crews can get a perfect view, what with you two on the ridgeline, if you'd like."
Gorlas winked over at Murillo as he said, "By all means, we shall wait then." The foreman trundled down the path into the pit to ensure that the crew captains were told what was going on. They'd enjoy the treat after a long day's work in the tunnels. As soon as the foreman was out of earshot, Gorlas grinned at Murillo.
"Now, anything more we should talk about, now that we've got no witness?"
"Thank you for the invitation," Murillo said, tightening the straps of his glove. "Turban Orr didn't deserve an honourable death. Hannet is your friend? Tell me, do you enjoy sleeping with vipers, or are you just stupid?"
"If that was an attempt to bring me to a boil, it was pathetic. You truly think I don't know all the tricks leading up to a duel? Gods below, old man. Still, I am pleased by your admission. Hannet will be delighted to hear that his suspicions were accurate. More important, he will find himself in my debt."
And then he cocked his head.
"Of course, the debt will be all the greater if I let you live. A duel unto wounding, leaving your fate in Hannet's hands. Yes, that would be perfect. Well, Murillo, shall it be wounding?"
"If you like,"
Murillo said.
"Are your boots pinching?"
"No."
"You seem in discomfort, Murillo, or is that just nerves?"
Bells clanged in the pit below, distant shouts, and out from the tunnel mouths spewed filthy figures looking barely human at this distance. Runners raced down the lines. Word was getting out.
"What's this Harlow boy to you, anyway?"
Murillo glanced back to Gorlas.
"You married Estrasian Dahl's daughter, didn't you? She's made herself very popular of late, hasn't she? Alas, I'm starting to understand why. You're not much of a man, are you, Gorlas?"
For all the counsellor's previous bravado, he paled in the late afternoon light.
"It's terrible, isn't it?"
Murillo went on.
"How every sordid detail, no matter how private and personal, so easily leaves the barricaded world of the well-born and races like wind-blown seeds among all us common folk, us low-born. Why, whatever happened to decency?"
The rapier rasped its way out of the sheath, and the point lifted towards Murillo.
"Draw your weapon, old man."
Crute of Taliant stepped inside. He saw Ralik Nom standing by the window, but it was shuttered closed. The man might as well be standing facing a wall. Oh, he was a strange one indeed, stranger now than he'd ever been before. All that silence, all that sense of something being very much wrong. In his head? Maybe, and that was a worrying thought, that Ralik Nom might not be right anymore.
"It's confirmed,"
said Crute, setting down the burlap sack filled with the makings for supper.
"One contract dissolved, a new one accepted. Stinks of desperation, doesn't it? Gods, Sebas even called me back, and that's an invitation no sane man would refuse."
He paused, eyeing his friend, and then said,
"So you may not be seeing much of me from now on. From what I've gathered, this new one's pretty straightforward, but it's the kind that'll shake up the precious bloods."
"Is it now?" Ralik asked, expressionless.
"Listen,"
said Crute, knowing he was betraying his nerves.
"I couldn't say no, could I? It's fine enough living off your coin, but that's hard on a man's pride. I've got a chance to get back into the middle of things again. I've got a chance to walk with the guild again. Ralik, I got to take it, you understand?"
"Is it that important to you, Crute?"
Crute nodded. "Then, said Relic. I had best leave your company.
I'm sorry about that. It's my being, what's that word again?
Compromised.
Exactly. Now, if you'd made your move on Seba, well, we wouldn't be in this situation, would we? It's the waiting that's been so hard.
There are no plans to replace Seba Krafar, said Relic. I am sorry if I have unintentionally misled you on that count. This is not to say we're uninterested in the guild. He hesitated. Croot, listen carefully. I can leave you some coin, enough for a while, a half year's worth, in fact. Just decline Seba's invitation. You don't know what you're getting into.
And you do? No, Relic. The point is, if I don't know, it's because I've been pushed out of things.
You should be thankful for that.
I don't need any patronizing shit from you, Relic Nom. You're all secrets now, nothing but secrets. But you'll live here with me and eat what I cook, and what about me? Oh, right, on the outside again, this time with you. Well, I can't live like that, so you'd better go. Don't think ill of me. I won't tell Seba about you.
Can I not buy your retirement, Croot?
No.
Relic nodded and then walked to the door. Guard yourself well, Croot.
You too, Relic.
Emerging from the tenement building's narrow back door, Relic Nom stepped out into the rank, rubbish-filled alley. His last venture into the world had seen him very nearly killed by Crocus Younghand, and of his time spent recovering at the Phoenix Inn, it was clear that no one who'd known of his presence had said a thing. Not Cropper, nor Cole, nor Murillo, nor Mies, or Irilta. The guild had not sniffed out his ignominious return. Even that wayward cousin of his, Torvald, had said nothing, although why that man had so vigorously avoided him was both baffling and somewhat hurtful. Anyway, in a sense, Relic remained invisible. He paused in the alley, still light, a ribbon of brightness directly above. It felt odd to be outside in the day, and he knew it would not be long before someone caught sight of him, recognizing his face, eyes widening with astonishment, and word would race back to Seba Krafar. And then? Well, the master would probably send one of his lieutenants to sound Relic out. What did he want? What did he expect from the guild? There might be an invitation as well, the kind that was deadly either way. Accept it and walk into an ambush, reject it and the hunt would begin. There were few who could take down Relic one-on-one, but that wouldn't be the preferred tactic in any case. No, it would be a quarrel to the back. There were other places he could hide. He could probably walk right back into the Finest house. But then, Croot was not the only one getting impatient. Besides, Relic had never much liked subterfuge. He'd not used it when he'd been active in the guild, after all, except when he was working, of course. No, the time had come to stir things awake. And if Seba Krafar's confidence had been rattled by a handful of rancorous Malazans, well, he was about to be sent reeling. The notion brought a faint smile to Relic's lips.
Yes, I am back.
He set out for the Phoenix Inn.
I am back, so let's get this started, shall we?
Echoing alarms at the blurred border between the Daru and Lakefront districts, a half-dozen streets behind them now as Barathol, holding Chara's hand as he would a child's, dragged the giant man through the late afternoon crowds. They had passed a few patrols, but word had yet to outdistance the two fugitives, although it was likely that this flight would ultimately prove anything but surreptitious. Guards and bystanders both could not help but recall the two huge foreigners, one onyx-skinned, the other the hue of stained rawhide, rushing past. Barathol had no choice but to dispense with efforts at stealth and subterfuge. Chara was bawling with all the indignant outrage of a toddler unjustly punished, astonished to discover that not all things were cute and to be indulged by adoring caregivers. That, say, shoving a sibling off a cliff was not quite acceptable behaviour. He had tried calming Chara down, but simple as Chara was, he was quick to sense disapproval, and Barathol had been unthinking and careless in expressing that disapproval. Well, rather, he had been shocked into carelessness. And now the huge child would wail unto eventual exhaustion, and that exhaustion was still a long way off. Two streets away from the harbour, three guards, 30 paces behind them, suddenly raised shouts, and now the chase was on for real. To Barathol's surprise, Chowra fell silent, and the smith pulled him up alongside him as they hurried along.
Chowra, listen to me. Get back to the ship. Do you understand? Back to the ship, to the lady, yes? Back to Spite. She'll hide you. To the ship, Chowra. Understand?
A tear-streaked face, cheeks blotchy, eyes red. Chowra nodded. Barathol pushed him ahead.
Go, on your own. I'll catch up with you. Go!
And Chowra went, lumbering, knocking people off their feet until a path miraculously opened before him. Barathol turned about to give the three guards some trouble, enough to purchase Chowra the time he needed, at least. He managed that well enough, with fists and feet, with knees and elbows, and if not for the arrival of reinforcements, he might even have won clear. Six more guards, however, proved about 5 too many, and he was wrestled to the ground and beaten half senseless. The occasional thought filtered weakly through the miasma of pain and confusion as he was roughly carried to the nearest jail. He'd known a cell before. It wasn't so bad, so long as the jailers weren't into torture. Yes, he could make a tour of jail cells, country to country, continent to continent. All he needed to do was start up a smithy without the local guild's approval. Simple enough. Then these fragmented notions went away, and the bliss of unconsciousness was unbroken for a time.
"'Tis the grand stupidity of our kind, dear Cutter, to see all the errors of our ways, yet find in ourselves the inability to do anything about them. We sit dumbfounded by despair, and for all our ingenuity, our perceptivity, for all our extraordinary capacity to see the truth of things, we hunker down like snails in a flood, sucked tight to our precious pebble, fearing the moment it is dislodged beneath us. Until that terrible calamity, we do nothing but cling. Can you even imagine a world where all crimes are punished, where justice is truly blind and holds out no hands happy to yield to the weight of coin and influence? Where one takes responsibility for his or her mistakes, acts of negligence, the deadly consequences of indifference or laziness? Nay, instead we slip and duck, dance and dodge, dance the dodge, slip-duck dance, feet a blur. Ourselves transformed into shadows that flit in chaotic discord. We are indeed masters of evasion, no doubt originally a survival trait, at least in the physical sense. But to have such instincts applied to the soul is perhaps our most egregious crime against morality. What we will do so that we may continue living with ourselves. In this we might assert that a survival trait can ultimately prove its own antithesis, and in the cancelling out thereof, why, we are left with the blank, dull, vacuous expression that Crupper now sees before him.
Sorry, what? Dear Cutter, this is a grave day, I am saying. A day of the misguided and the misapprehended, a day of mischance and misery. A day in which to grieve the unanticipated, this yawning stretch of too late that follows fell decisions. And the stars will plummet, and if we truly possessed courage, we would ease ourselves with great temerity into that high, tottering footwear of the gods, and in seeing what they see, in knowing what they have come to know, we would at last comprehend the madness of struggle, the absurdity of hope, and off we would stumble, wailing our way into the dark future. We would weep, my friend, we would weep.
Maybe I have learned all about killing, Cutter said in a mumble, his glazy eyes seemingly fixed on the tankard in his hand. And maybe assassins don't spare a thought as to who deserves what, or even motivations. Coin in hand or love in the heart, reward has so many flavors. But is this what she really wants? Or was that some kind of careless burst, like a flask never meant to be opened? Shatters, everything pours out, staining your hands, staining everything.
Cutter, said Crupper in a low, soft but determined tone. Cutter, you must listen to Crupper now. You must listen. He is done with rambling, with his own bout of terrible, grievous helplessness. Listen, Cutter. There are paths that must not be walked, paths where going back is impossible, no matter how deeply you would wish it, no matter how loud the cry in your soul. Dearest friend, you must
Shaking himself, Cutter rose suddenly. "I need a walk," he said. "She couldn't have meant it. That future she paints, it's a fairy tale. Of course it is. Has to be. No and no and no, but..." Cropper watched as the young man walked away, watched as Cutter slipped through the doorway of the Phoenix Inn and was gone from sight. "Sad truth," Cropper said, his audience of none sighing in agreement, "that a tendency towards verbal excess can so defeat the precision of meaning. That intent can be so well disguised in majestic plethora of nuance, of rhythm both serious and mocking, of this penchant for self-referential slyness, that the unwitting simply skip on past, imagining their time to be so precious, imagining themselves above all manner of conviction, save that of their own witty perfection. Sigh and sigh again. See Cropper totter in these high shoes. Nay, even his balance is not always precise, no matter how condign he may be in so many things. Totter, I say, as down fall the stars, and off wail the gods, and helplessness is an ocean in flood, ever rising. But we shall not drown alone, shall we? No, we shall have plenty of company in this chill comfort. The guilty and the innocent, the quick and the thick, the wise and the dumb, the righteous and the wicked. The flood levels all, faces down in the swells. Oh my, oh my." A miracle, better than merely recounted second or third hand, witnessed. Witnessed, the four bearers would have carried their charge directly past, but then, see, a gnarled, feeble hand reached out, damp fingertips pressing against Merla's forehead. And the bearers, who were experienced in such random gestures of deliverance, halted. She stared up into the prophet's eyes and saw terrible pain, a misery so profound it purified, and knowledge beyond anything her useless, dross-filled mind could comprehend.
"My son," she gasped. "My son, myself, oh my heart."
"Self, yes," he said,
fingers pressing against her forehead like four iron nails, pinning her guilt and shame, her weakness, her useless stupidity.
"I can bless that, so I shall. Do you feel my touch, dear woman?"
And Merla could not but nod, for she did feel it. Oh yes, she felt it. From behind her, Bedek's quavering voice drifted past.
"Glorious one, our son has been taken, kidnapped. We know not where, and we thought...
"Your son is beyond salvation," said the prophet. "He has the vileness of knowledge within his soul. I can sense how you two merged in his creation. Yes, your blood was his poison of birth. He understands compassion, but he chooses it not. He understands love, but uses it as a weapon. He understands the future, and knows it does not wait for anyone, not even him. He is a living maw, your son, a living maw, which all of the world must feed."
The hand withdrew, leaving four precise spots of ice on Merla's forehead, every nerve dead there forevermore.
"Even the crippled god must reject such a creature. But you, Merla, and you, Bedek, I bless. I bless you both in your lifelong blindness, your insensitive touch, the fugue of your malnourished minds. I bless you in the crumpling of the two delicate flowers in your hands, your two girls. For you have made of them versions no different from you, no better, perhaps much worse. Merla, Bedek, I bless you in the name of empty pity. Now go."
And she staggered back, stumbled into the cart, knocking it and Bedek over. He cried out, falling hard onto the cobbles, and a moment later she landed on top of him. The snap of his left arm was loud in the wake of the now resumed procession of bearers and prophet, the swirling press of begging worshippers sweeping in, stepping without care, without regard. A heavy boot stamped down on Merla's hip, and she shrieked as something broke, lancing agony into her right leg. Another foot collided with her face, toenails slashing one cheek, heels on hands, fingers, ankles. Bedek caught a momentary glimpse upward, to see the face of a man desperate to climb over them, for they were in his way, and he wanted to reach the prophet, and the man looked down, his pleading expression transforming into one of black hate, and he drove the point of his boot into Bedek's throat, crushing the trachea. Unable to breathe past the devastation that had once been his throat, Bedek stared up with bulging eyes. His face deepened to a shade of blue-gray, and then purple. The awareness in the eyes flattened out, went away and away. Still screaming, Merla dragged herself over her husband, noting his stillness but otherwise uncomprehending, and pulled herself through a forest of hard, shifting legs. Shins and knees, jabbing feet, out into a space, suddenly open, clear, the cobbles slick beneath her. Although she was not yet aware of them, four spots of gangrene were spreading across her forehead. She could smell something foul, horribly foul, as though someone had dropped something in passing, somewhere close. She just couldn't see it yet. The pain of her broken hip was now a throbbing thing, a dead weight she dragged behind her, growing ever more distant in her mind. We run from our place of wounding, no different from any other beast. We run from our place of wounding. Run or crawl, crawl or drag, drag or reach. She realized that even such efforts had failed her. She was broken everywhere. She was dying.
See me? I have been blessed. He has blessed me. Bless you all.
He could barely stand, and now he must duel. Murillo untied his coin pouch and tossed it towards the foreman who had just returned, gasping and red-faced. The bag landed in a cloud of dust, a heavy thud.
I came for the boy, Murillo said. That's more than he's worth. Do you accept the payment, foreman?
He does not, said Gorlas. No, I have something special in mind for little Harlow.
He's not part of any of this.
You just made him so, Murillo. One of your clan. Maybe even a whelp of one of your useless friends in the Phoenix Inn. Your favored hangout, yes? Hanut knows everything there is to know about you. No, the boy's in this, and that's why you won't have him. I will, to do with as I please.
Murillo drew his rapier.
What makes people like you, Gorlas?
I could well ask the same of you.
Well, a lifetime of mistakes, and so we are perhaps more alike than either of us would care to admit.
He saw the foreman bend down to collect the purse. The odious man hefted it and grinned.
About those interest payments, Councillor?
Gorlas smiled.
Why, it seems you can clear your debt after all.
Murillo assumed his stance, point extended, sword arm bent slightly at the elbow, left shoulder thrown back to reduce the plane of his exposed torso. He settled his weight, gingerly, down through the center of his hips. Smiling still, Gorlas Vidicus moved into a matching pose, although he was leaning slightly forward. Not a duelist ready to retreat, then. Murillo recalled that from the fight he'd seen the very end of, the way Gorlas would not step back, unwilling to yield ground, unwilling to accept that sometimes pulling away earned advantages. No, he would push and push, surrendering nothing. He wrapped Murillo's blade with his own, a contemptuous batting aside to gauge response. There was none. Murillo simply resumed his line. Gorlas probed with a rapier's point, jabbing here and there round the bell hilt, teasing and gambling with the quillons that could trap his blade. But for Murillo to do so, he would have to twist and fold his wrist. Not much, but enough for Gorlas to make a darting thrust into the opened guard, and so Murillo let the man play with that. He was in no hurry. Footsore and weary as he was, he suspected he would have but one solid chance, sooner or later, to end this. Point to lead kneecap, or down to lead boot, or a flicking slash into wrist tendons, crippling the sword arm, possibly forever. or higher into the shoulder, stop hitting a lunge. Gorlas pressed, closing the distance, and Murillo stepped back. And that hurt. He could feel wetness in his boots, that wretched clear liquid oozing out from the broken blisters. "I think," ventured Gorlas, "there's something wrong with your feet, Murillo. You move like a man standing on nails." Murillo shrugged. He was past conversation. It was hard enough concentrating through the stabs of pain. "Such an old-style stance you have, old man. So upright." Gorlas resumed the flitting, wavering motions of his rapier, minute threats here and there. He had begun a rhythmic rocking back and forth on the balls of his feet, attempting to lull Murillo into that motion. When he finally launched into his attack, the move was explosive, lightning fast. Murillo tracked the feints, caught and parried the lunge and snapped out a riposte, but he was stepping back as he did so, and his point snipped the cloth of Gorlas's sleeve. Before he could ready himself, the younger duelist extended his attack with a hard parrying beat, and then a second lunge, throwing his upper body far forward, closing enough to make Murillo's retreat insufficient, as was his parry. Sizzling fire in his left shoulder, staggering back, the motion tugging the point free of his flesh, Murillo righted himself and then straightened.
"Blood drawn," he said, voice tightened by pain.
"Oh, that," said Gorlas, resuming his rocking motion once more. "I've changed my mind."
"One insult too many. I never learn."
Murillo felt his heart pounding. The scar of his last near-fatal wounding seemed to be throbbing as if eager to reopen. He could feel blood pulsing down from his pierced shoulder muscle, could feel warm trickles running down the length of his upper arm to soak the cloth at his elbow.
"Blood drawn," he repeated. "As you guessed, I am in no shape to duel beyond that, Gorlas. We were agreed before a witness."
Gorlas glanced over at his foreman.
"Do you recall precisely what you heard?"
The old man shrugged.
"Thought there was something about wounding."
Gorlas frowned. The foreman cleared his throat.
"But that's all. A discussion, I think. I heard nothing firmed up between you."
Gorlas nodded. "Our witness speaks." A few hundred onlookers in the pit below were making restless sounds. Murillo wondered if Harlow was among them. "Ready yourself," Gorlas said. So it was to be this way. A decade past, Murillo would have been standing over this man's corpse, regretful, of course, wishing it all could have been handled peacefully. And that was the luxury of days gone past, that cleaner world, while everything here, now, ever proved so messy.
"I didn't come here to die this day. I'd better do something about that. I need to survive this for Harlow."
He resumed his stance. Well, he was debilitated, enough to pretty much ensure that he would fight defensively, seeking only ripostes and perhaps a counterattack, taking a wound to deliver a death. All of that would be in Gorlas's mind, would shape his tactics. Time, then, to surprise the bastard. His step and lunge was elegant, a fluid forward motion rather quick for a man his age. Gorlas, caught on the forward tilt of his rocking, was forced to jump a half-step back, parrying hard and without precision. His riposte was wild and inaccurate, and Murillo caught it with a high parry of his own, following through with a second attack, the one he had wanted to count from the very first, a fully extended lunge straight for his opponent's chest, heart or lungs, it didn't matter which. But somehow, impossibly, Gorlas had stepped close, inside and to one side of that lunge. His half-step back had not been accompanied by any shift in weight, simply a repositioning of his upper body, and this time his thrust was not at all wild. Murillo caught a flash along the length of Daru steel, and then he could not breathe. Something was pouring down the front of his chest and spurting up into his mouth. He felt part of his throat tearing from the inside out as Gorlas slashed his blade free and stepped to the right. Murillo twisted round to track him, but the motion lost all control, and he continued on, legs collapsing under him, and now he was lying on the stony ground. The world darkened. He heard Gorlas say something, possibly regretful, but probably not.
"Oh, Harlow, I am so sorry,"
So sorry.
And the darkness closed in. He was rocked momentarily awake by a kick to his face, but that pain quickly flushed away, along with everything else. Gorlas Vidicus stood over Murillo's corpse. "Get that carter to take the body back," he said to the foreman, bending down to clean his blade on the threadbare silk sleeve of his victim's weapon arm. "Have him deliver it to the Phoenix Inn, rapier and all." From the pit below, people were cheering and clanging their tools like some ragtag mob of barbarians. Gorlas faced them and raised his weapon in salute. The cheering redoubled. He turned back to the foreman. "An extra tankard of ale for the crews tonight."
"They will toast your name, Councillor."
"Oh, and have someone collect the boy for me."
"It's his shift in the tunnels, I think, but I can send someone to get him."
"Good, and they don't have to be gentle about it either. But make sure nothing so bad he won't recover. If they kill him, I will personally disembowel every one of them. Make sure they understand."
"I will, Councillor."
The foreman hesitated.
"I never seen such skill. I never seen such skill. I thought he had you."
"I'm sure he thought so too. Go find that carter now."
"On my way, Councillor."
"Oh, and I'll take that purse, so we're clear." The foreman rushed over to deliver it. Feeling the bag's weight for the first time, Gorlas raised his brows. A damned year's wages for this foreman, right here. Probably all Murillo had, cleaned right out. 3 times as much as the interest this fool owed him. Then again, if the foreman had stopped to count out the right amount, intending to keep the rest, well, Gorlas would have had 2 bodies to dispose of rather than just one. So maybe the old man wasn't so stupid after all. It had, Gorlas decided, been a good day. And so the ox began its long journey back into the city, clumping along the cobbled road, and in the cart's bed lay the body of a man who might have been precipitous, who might indeed have been too old for such deadly ventures. But no one could say that his heart had not been in the right place, nor could anyone speak of a lack of courage. Raising a most grave question, if courage and heart are not enough, what is? The ox could smell blood, and liked it not one bit. It was a smell that came with predators, with hunters, notions stirring the deepest parts of the beast's brain. It could smell death as well, there in its wake, and no matter how many clumping steps it took, that smell did not diminish. And this it could not understand, but was resigned to nonetheless. There was no room in the beast for grieving. The only sorrow it knew was for itself, so unlike its 2-legged masters. Flies swarmed, ever unquestioning, and the day's light fell away.